Oh, hey there, listeners and juicers. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that if you have fallen in love with the Draw Your Dice podcast and want to help put some new fruit on the table, but don't feel comfortable making a monthly commitment, well, you can support the show via the Acast supporter feature. No gift too large, nor too small. Just click on the link in the show description and know that I am sending you the strongest hug when you do so.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Where you start with the character, you figure out what's the experience you kind of want the person watching the movie or reading the book to have. And you start with a character and then build the world based on what does the character need to experience. Because the audience is going to be invested in the characters, the character and characters of the story. You want to take them on this journey, and you can design everything based on that. And so,
my name is Jeremy Gage, and welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. This is an educational show involving all things tabletop role-playing industry. Listen alongside me as we hear from creators, entrepreneurs, and supporters about their personal best practices, principles, and philosophies. I encourage anyone from the budding game designer to a seasoned publisher and everyone in between to sit down with us and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. My name is Jeremy Gage, and today's guest that I brought for you is a long-time-awaited joiner to the coven that is the DYD alumni. Recommended to me by Randy Lubin. Randy, if you're out there, this is all really possible because of you, and I love that connection. But today's guest is the creator of The Zone, has been on other podcasts, and is just a big voice in the tabletop space and thinks about a lot of things like accessibility and is a UX designer. I would like to welcome to the show, Raph D'Amico.
It's good to be here, Jeremy. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm so glad to be here today.
Of course, I'm glad to have you here. Well, I love that for anyone who's at home, I always talk with the guests before we start hitting record. So there's definitely some off-mic icebreaker banter. But I love that every single guest is on the same page. About, like, I'm just walking on stage for the first time.
Well, so I love it. I think we've also got the signature Draw Your Dice crowd noise.
Yeah.
It's becoming a signature. It's part of the appeal of being on the show. You feel so seen, you know?
It should be in the trailer that I'm making currently. Anyways, not about me. Raph, why don't you give a quick introduction, any plugs or anything, because I want you to make the dollars as well, for people who may not know who you are, and as well as pronoun things and everything like that.
Oh, yeah. So my name is Raph D'Amico, and my pronouns are he, him. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm a UX designer by day and game designer by other times. And yeah, I love making weird kind of experiential games, and also have this huge project we went on for the last 3 years that came out pretty recently called The Zone, which is a play to lose kind of doomed adventure in the style of Annihilation or Stalker. And it was a game that started in the kind of physical world. Then when the pandemic happened, I spent almost a year rebuilding it as a digital experience. And yeah, you can find it at thezonerpg.com. You can find me at Raph D'Amico on Twitter.
Amazing. Raph, additionally, as an icebreaker for the listeners, what was sort of your first role-playing game that got you into the hobby or LARP? I know that you and Randy also have LARP experience in a big way. And what was the game that got you to say, like, ooh, I could make something. I want to create something. Walk us through that.
Yeah. It's been a journey. You know, I was making games from a pretty young age, video games, I think like a lot of folks listening. I was modding first-person shooters, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I just knew games were awesome, and I wanted to participate in them. And D&D was always this thing that was like vaguely on my radar, but really far away. Like, I knew it was a thing that people did. Probably the closest thing, the closest I came to it was like painting miniatures in Warhammer 40K. And I'm just going to say something. If you paint miniatures and you want the paint to dry faster, don't put them in front of a space heater. This is my advice to the people of the Draw Your Dice podcast. And but I'd say, you know, like for me, probably my first experience, something that's close to RPGs, was improv. So when I came to the States as an adult, I went to Chicago first, and I did improv at Second City and at I.O. And, you know, improv has lots of different levels of structure, from like fully played out real kind of theater feeling things to, you know, Whose Line Is It Anyway in games. But within it, there's just all these things that have the same kind of structure as like mini LARPs, or, you know, improv itself is kind of like an unstructured kind of mega LARP. Mm-hmm. And just got completely obsessed with it. I'm completely obsessed with storytelling. And so when I came to San Francisco, Randy was one of my first friends, and we immediately bonded over storytelling and storytelling design and like breaking down stories. And we started playing games together. And that was kind of my first experience of Microscope and Fiasco, like really that set of games. Like, actually, I didn't play a proper game of D&D until last year. Mm. Yeah. And so in the middle of that, like the very first proper RPG I played was actually Exalted, which I did really, I can't tell you too much about, because we played one session of it completely improperly. And most of the session was us doing a single kick that lasted 45 minutes, because Exalted has this stunting mechanic where you get more dice if you describe something more awesome. Mm. And so there was a single kick that took out a room full of goblins that we described in such excruciating detail that it took almost an hour. And then a month later, and I would say like this is probably the kind of the seed of me deciding that I wanted to make these kinds of games, was I went to Burning Man only once in my life, 2013. And before I went there, a friend of mine said to me, you know, there's this really cool thing you can do at Burning Man that feels kind of like being in an open world RPG. You go over to the center camp, and they have a mail service. So people send in mail to Burning Man, to their friends, with some strange hope that it'll get there. It's a bizarre hope. I don't know why you would do this. And there's a kind of center camp where it gets collected, and then people just walk it over, bike it over to different camps. And it's this really cool way of just exploring this giant space, you know? Because it'll just send you to places you might not otherwise go, to like the boonies. Wow. And so I walk up to the counter, and the guy kind of takes one look at me. He's like, I don't want to give this person too much mail. This is clearly not getting where it's needed to go. He reluctantly gives me like three small envelopes. And I spent the rest of the day just essentially doing the fetch quest, like deliver the first mail to like one side of the camp. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, second piece of mail to this place where people looked at me suspiciously. And then, like, the third mail, I arrive at this camp that's in the middle of a meeting, like a big, like, camp meeting. It's like 50 people. And I arrive right at the tail end where this guy gets up to the front. He's like, hey, you know, by the way, if you'd like to come and play some storytelling games, come to my trailer at noon on Friday. And this is, like, Tuesday, and if there's one thing I know about Burning Man, and I don't know too much about the culture, it's that time basically has no meaning. Mm-hmm. So I thought, man, the chutzpah of saying, come to a specific place at a specific time? Astonishing. I must get in on this. It must be very important. And so I showed up 3 days later, and he pulls out Archipelago, mm-hmm. which I don't think a lot of people know this game, because it's almost like this parallel universe from the universe of D&D. It's like it's almost like from a completely, it's, you know, it's by Matthijs Halter, and it's more, I wish I knew more about the history of it. It feels like it comes more from this kind of LARPy kind of freeform world. There's no dice. It's a card-based resolution mechanic, and every player has responsibility for a different part of the world. Each character you kind of create at the table is super, super light, and they have a single kind of faded kind of thing that they're headed towards. And you create a map together at the beginning, going around adding to this land and each becoming responsible for an aspect. Like, I control the oceans. So if there's anything to do with oceans in the plot line, then you're the player who resolves it. There's no GM. And spent the afternoon in this blissfully air-conditioned trailer just playing this game, and it just completely blew me away. I'd never seen something that had the mechanics of an RPG, but the feeling of improv, it really kind of stirred something up in me. And then afterwards, by the way, I discovered that the guy whose trailer it was Peter Atkinson, one of the founders of Wizards of the Coast, which made it even more surreal. It's just like, we're just chatting afterwards. Just like, what?
Were you there with Max Pfeffer?
You mean in that session?
Yeah.
I have no idea. That's the crazy thing. Like, you're there. You don't really know each other's names.
That's so crazy because...
It's super bizarre. I might have been.
I might. I don't know if I have to go back and listen to Max's episode if I'm going to include this in this episode. But I have to ask because Max gave a very what you're describing is a very, very, very similar experience to Max, who's like, yeah, one day I was out like near a Burning Man tent, and some guy was like, hey, show up at my trailer later. We're gonna play a game called Archipelago. He's like, oh, okay, sure, I'll show up, and then just like went to this random dude's trailer. So. I'm like, were you there at the same time and you just didn't? Do you know who Max Pfeffer is? Because Max knows
no,
Randy.
I don't. I think.
Oh, my God. I have to find out because he also said he met Peter Atkinson. I was like, wait a minute.
I would love that. That would be so exciting. Now, I've heard since that this is something. Apparently, he's notorious for doing this. You know, I met him a couple of years ago again and told him the story. And it was just, you know, it was really nice to come full circle because to me, it was basically like a fever dream. Mm-hmm. And so being able to meet someone who had that experience back out into the real world, it's like, oh, okay, it really happened. This isn't Narnia, you know?
Well, it wasn't like a real mirage haze.
But if you think about it, it's like the perfect way to really, you know, kick off your RPG life, right? Because, you know, that's the dream of RPGs, you know, that idea of like, just you're going about your life and something really weird happens. You get pulled into this strange adventure. And, you know, actually, like, I think that's part of the beauty of this art form is you can create that feeling for people. Like, yeah, like the whole weird tent and coming into, you know, it's a stranger's game that they could hold out for you and takes you this whole world. That's a pretty extreme environment. But I feel like every time we pick up an RPG, we're channeling some of that energy, some of that, like, you know, Ford Prefect from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy saying, like, hey, like, you know, put this fish in your ear and get ready to be teleported off the planet.
There's a lot of beautiful similarities for me with those stories is that, one, I went to college for theater and dance at one point, and I joined the college's improv troupe Faces for Radio. And I still think that's a great name.
That's a great name.
It's a good name. Zach Gennardi came up with it. So, Zach, if you're ever listening to the show, shout out to you. But, yeah, I think that's the thing that sort of got, because I didn't play D&D until like 9 years later, but there is always this thing that I loved about improv inside of me that was like a loose gaming structure. There's also another game at my college called Humans vs. Zombies. I know that some colleges play it in different areas of the states or even around the world maybe. But for anyone who doesn't know, Humans vs. Zombies is everyone gets Nerf guns, they wear bandanas, they run around campus, some people maybe parkour it. It's basically like long distance tag, essentially. But yeah, there's something about those moments where everyone sort of gets in the same zone or on the same page in that theater of the mind aspect, like, oh, we both know where this scene is going and we love it. There's just nothing more magical for me except for a quiet kitchen. A quiet like line in a restaurant is also a beautiful moment for me. But yeah, I think there's something very cool about, I don't know, maybe it's the GM in me, but I recently, not recently, but in my real life play group, I added two members on recommendation from my partner. One of the members is an artist, And they met at like a gallery one time and they were just hanging out and chatting. And she was like, yeah, I really liked her. And then I saw some comment about like she likes role-playing games. Why don't you see if she wants to play? So I invited her and her partner, the artist's partner. I just don't want to say names in case they don't want that on the podcast. That's why I have to, like, my mind's doing galaxy brain-ish today. But it was his, like, first role-playing game thing, too. And ever since, he's now GMing his games, his own games, and, like, is having a ball. And we played lots of different games, so really open to that as well. It's really a beautiful experience that I think improv role-playing game, just, like, playing. I think the big key thing is that, like, you find moments to be, you know, kids again, adult kids, but even then, like, play is for adults as well, just in different formats. And I love that. I love your lineage of tabletop touches.
My random walk into this just wonderful world. And like, I mean, you mentioned the kind of the theater thing. You know that phrase in improv, the idea of like blackout improv, where you come out of the scene, you're like, what just happened?
Yeah,
it sounds like you've had that experience where,
yeah,
you just don't even remember the scene. You're just so in it, and the scene ends, and you know, can hear a pin drop because clearly it was resonating with everyone. And in channeling that, I mean, games are one of the only other places I feel like you channel that. And it's like the immersion in the movie theater. It actually, honestly, it connects to something really much bigger for me, which is I remember hearing, I can't remember who said this, but it was someone who was kind of pondering the history of music and thinking about how weird recorded music is, because for most of human history, if you wanted to hear music, you had to make music and, or just, you know the like small number of people who come play chamber music or have it as part of some kind of cultural ritual. So, you know, now it feels the idea of, for example, like singing in church or other places where you are singing end up being these kind of side points to spending 50 hours listening to Spotify, you know? And thinking about how like recorded music in like the 50s and like the explosion of people being able to go to these like huge like recorded concerts and also buy just records for the first time, kind of control their music listening experience. Also, I think created the sense of like music is something other people do. Like, oh, I don't do music. Like someone else makes professional music and I consume it. And I feel like storytelling has had a little bit of that journey to some extent, where it always blows me away to think that when you go see a blockbuster movie, there's like literally like $2 to $3 million being burnt in every minute that you're watching. It's just like just money should be like set on fire for, you know, for your ritual enjoyment. And I see storytelling games, role-playing games as kind of a counter to that. They're giving people power back to say, you know what, like I could watch a movie with my friends. And by the way, I love movies, and we should talk about this. I know from your last episodes that you also care a lot about like story structure and movie structure. That was a big entry point for me too. But there's something kind of subversive and awesome about saying, you know, we're going to turn the TV off, or we're not going to go to the movie theater tonight. We're going to create a story of our own. It's epic. It's so cool.
It gives people. Go ahead. No, you.
No. I was done. I was just.
I'm here to riff.
I'm excited, you know?
Yeah, me too. No, I think there's something really beautiful about like, you know, you mentioned how like someone goes, oh, I'm not a musician. I don't make music. I listen to music, right? Like you feel like you can add that to ritual. Before tabletop games, I think there's something about you. It gives you the opportunity to be an actor, right? It gives you the opportunity to explore theory of thought. Isn't that I don't know. This is me going way into like the
go ether, there. It's like, you know, this rocket.
What is the theory of thought, but to extrapolate like a concept in your mind, right? Like all the time, you know, some classic things I'm sure a lot of people do is like you're laying in bed, you're up at like 2 a.m., it's dark, you don't have anything on because you're trying to sleep. And then just that thought of like, what if someone like broke into my house right now? What would I do? Right. And you're like running that thought experiment over and over. It's like, okay, I could grab the lamp, throw it. But what if they, I don't know, what if there are two of them? Then what do I do? Well, I could roll over the bed, high jump kick the other one, and then, and so.
Dude, I'm so happy I'm not the only one who does this.
I'm almost, there's a good chance that almost every person in the world has this moment in their adult life when they start to live on their own. What happens if I have an intruder? What do I do? But
I'll throw the bed sheets over them and then, you know, like...
ha! Smokescreen! But the reason I bring that up is that what tabletop games, improv, I guess in general, LARP even, allows you to run thought scenarios that aren't just like intruders breaking, but like emotional stuff. Like, how do I explain something to my kid? Or how do I connect? How do I communicate with someone at work that I'm not finding the ability to communicate with in our day-to-day rituals, right? Like, and maybe you're not thinking about those things on the offset when you're in those moments, or even when you're playing, be like, huh, in play yesterday, when I talked to Gorthak about, you know, he's not swinging his sword right, and we trained, maybe there's a softer approach that I can do to David in accounting about his data analysis. I don't know. There's a lot of emergent role play there for me in my mind.
I love that. That's so odd. Like, I got a riff off that because for me, what that speaks to is this honestly, like, this fundamental aspect of being human,
mm-hmm.
Which is our ability to think ahead, to plan. Like, you know, like the moment where we became human, Homo sapiens, you know, was this moment where, you know, we climbed down from the trees and our brains got bigger and we lost a lot of our muscle mass and traded it for these like lanky bodies that are flexible and can, you know, make tools. And like a lot of that is this ability to strategize and to plan ahead. And I think about, you know, that whole story about how orcas in captivity have this particular issue where their dorsal fins start to collapse because they're swimming in the same circle always. They're not going super far. There's way less water pressure than they're used to. So they're operating at just like a fraction of their capacity, their potential. Mm. And so their, you know, beautiful dorsal fin literally just starts collapsing and it just becomes, you know, it's really sad to look at. Mm-hmm. Look out for it next time you're in an aquarium. There you go. Just turned your aquarium visit into a total bummer.
No. And now it also makes you question, where's the other 90% of our brains going? Like,
so limitless. So yeah. I feel like storytelling is a little bit of a similar thing for people, where I think our ability to like plan ahead and to create stories and to think about, well, when this might happen, this will happen. I think when we're disempowered, we become these kind of smaller versions of ourselves, hashtag capitalism. And storytelling is this way for us to get power back and to just like expand into like infinite worlds and to honestly like to be kind of our best selves. There's many things that make people awesome and stories are just one of them. So I always feel like when I see someone light up telling a story, particularly someone who's a first-time role player, I'm like, yes, that's what you got. It's like Superman discovering that he can fly, right? Just being like, oh, yeah, that's what it means to be Kryptonian. I can fly. Same thing with humans and stories.
I just have to mark this moment, that's all.
I don't know what that means, but I'm honored. Or afraid, terrified.
Trying some new transcription stuff so I can get more accessibility to the channel. But yeah, I think it's all about firing off neurons. You know what I mean? Like, if we're not pushing ourselves to connect and adapt and like when you have your own business, right? Like a lot of people complain about like the day to day and they're going like to work, living paycheck by paycheck and things like that. Are they, and that's by product of our society. I'm speaking to America in general. I don't know how it operates in other countries, if I have any international listeners, but it's like they try to put you in corporate buildings and want you to handle menial tasks that are easily repeatable, don't require a lot of problem solving. And then you get into a space where, like, I was working in the restaurant industry for 10 years and I was a prep cook, but I would be working like 12 to 16 hour shifts, like 5 to 6 days out of the week.
Damn.
And I had zero time to like think about anything else. So any problem solving I did was about like, oh, I need to get the most I can out of the salmon, or I need to make sure that the sauces are prepped. And like those can be repeatable over time. I'm not thinking about now as I start like a podcast business of like, okay, how do I market and what's the best way to make that accessible to people and how do I monetize this? And like I'm solving a lot of different problems and a lot of different ethos. And I feel like my brain is growing by the second. I want to mega mine so bad. But yeah, I definitely think there's something to the thought of putting yourself with storytelling, putting this back into the podcast of playing games, storytelling and problem solving, theory crafting that really exercises the mind. Right. I think is that there is an exercise here that is free form and collaborative, so you're getting a lot of different perspectives inside of that space as well. So you're being challenged. It's challenging. It's challenging exercise for your brain, and eventually you'll find a flow state. So yeah, really good thoughts. And this is just an icebreaker.
I love that.
Just an icebreaker.
Oh, well, God. Ice has been broken, shattered,
shattered,
vaporized, dusted.
Best friends. Thanos. Best friend. All right, let's get into the meat of this whole kit and caboodle. Let's talk about the zone. So usually my opening question with this, Raf, is why make the zone? You sort of come from like a video game mod background. You have a UX design career. What weren't you seeing that caused you to be like, there should be a game like the zone?
Yeah, so it's funny. I never actually answered your question of what was the thing that empowered me to, you know, make a game in the first place. And that's actually like a really good place to start, which is, let's say it's like a few things come together. For me, the real core of it was the moment that the zone was born. I had just gone through a huge breakup and a very, very stressful time in my life, a very stressful time at work. And I was hanging out with Randy and some folks, and we ended up playing a game called Love in the Time of Saith, Jason Morningstar game that's a riff off of Archipelago. And I had that Archipelago experience just in the back of my mind, you know, just it's always just sitting there just at all times. And what Love in the Time of Saith adds on to it is it basically says, like, okay, you got these like core mechanics of Archipelago. And those mechanics are very, very freeform. They don't there's some content, but you can, and there's some implication that you're going to tell some kind of like heroic story. You got this map, you know, like it's there's some implications of it, but you can kind of go in any direction. Love of the Time of Saith is basically a Viking blood opera, which features this like love quintangle, you know, whatever goes five ways, of characters who are basically set up to be on a collision course with each other. And they're just like, the game is really supposed to end in like a field of blood. It's like everyone is dead, like horribly. And so, for example, you got the princess is in love with I can't remember what the archetype is, but let's call him the knight. You know, they love each other. They're having this. Oh, wait, no, sorry. The knight is infatuated with the princess. The princess doesn't know who he is. The knight is a werewolf. The princess is destined to be married to this, like, evil vizier from, like, this other, you know, adjacent kingdom. And her father is the old king who's dying, who has gotten the knight, who doesn't know the knight is infatuated with his daughter, but who's assigned the knight to protect him. The knight wants to protect her, obviously, from the grand vizier. The grand vizier wants to take over the king's kingdom and using subterfuge. And the Saith is the witch, you know, who gives the princess kind of secret lessons, and I think maybe possibly also the king maybe has cursed the knight. I can't really remember, but either way, at the beginning of the game, you've got all these dynamics that are set up that just make it inevitable that, you know, the knight's going to turn into a werewolf and murder everyone, and the princess is going to try and run away, but it'll go horribly wrong. And like, it's just, it's beautiful, and it uses the same Archipelago mechanics. And playing it, the thing that got me about it, I've been playing a bunch of these Jason Morningstar LARPs and kind of smaller games. And the thing that his work just absolutely just blows me away with is that he puts just enough and no more. It's like the perfect amount of content that you can just kind of pick it up And LARP is really good at this. You can just kind of start playing. And there's so much thought process about how getting into the game isn't this thing you do before playing, but it's part of the experience of the game itself. And the other thing that it got me about it was just seeing how minimal you could make the rule set and the experience and still create this incredibly guided experience. And I'll just connect this to something, which is like the first like proper, you know, RPG that I made was actually with Randy. We used to meet up every few months on weekends and just say like, let's just make some stuff this weekend. And one time we were just riffing on this. And, you know, I know it is so flawed in so many ways. We were riffing off the hero's journey. And we're like, what if he just made a game that was just like the hero's journey as the structure? And you have like some structured prompts that just walk you through that process, save the cat style. Again, such a reductionist storytelling style, but also, you know, if the goal is to get total beginners to tell a cool story in half an hour, some of that reduction can be useful with like nice little prompts and some kind of pre-made characters. And the character is just like a card with a drawing that I made and three aspects. And we started playtesting it with folks who just weren't role-playing game people at all. And you just give them this structure. They see this board of cards. They know exactly what they got to do. 30 minutes later, they've told like a really quick, like essentially kind of like a movie outline. So I was thinking back to that, and it just all came together for me. And I would say like that was kind of like the Tinder. Mm-hmm. But the spark was I had just seen Annihilation three times. And
I think it's a good movie. I like it.
You know, I think the majority opinion of that movie is like kind of cool, kind of weird. And then there's like a small number of people who are just like, this movie plugged itself into my brain stem and has just like taken up residence there. And I'm one of those people. Like, you know, I can stop looking at it. There's just some such deep themes. So I was like, okay, like Viking blood opera, everyone starting in a certain place, having their fates essentially predetermined with this like lightweight system around it. Mm-hmm. And then Annihilation, you got that topology. I think a lot about storytelling topology, like what's the shape of a story when you separate it out from the content. That topology of a bunch of people go into a place, they each get picked off one by one, someone makes it to the center. That's an interesting shape. Mm-hmm. Interesting thing about that, that shape also exists for example, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But asking yourself, like, what's the shape of a story that you want to create? For me, like, Annihilation, just that shape just, like, seared itself into my brain. And I think it was, like, a week or two later, I kind of gathered some friends, and we played the first playtest, and I really kind of used Love in the Time of Seth as an initial model, where, again, I had, like, all the same characters as Annihilation. Really, it was, like, very much like Annihilation the game in the very first version.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, the scientist was kind of resentful of the, you know, the chaplain because, you know, it's science. No, it's God. You know, like, really trying to set up those tensions at the beginning. And I realized immediately, kind of in the first playtest, that it really wasn't about the characters. There was like a solo journey you would go on as your character. You go on this self-annihilation, this self-destruction. Mm-hmm. There's this really incredibly fun thing that happens in play-to-lose games where you get the ability to like totally self-destroy your character because you know that they have to be destroyed anyway. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same attachment as like, well, I have to like level up to level 50 in 7 years.
Yeah.
Which is cool too, by the way, but that really kind of came out. And then the other thing that came out was just, and I think this comes back really to the beginning of your question, like the thing that I felt like really needed to exist in the world was really two things, like games that played with this less literal and more magical realist narrative, because there's one thing I learned from improv is that really like two disparate things can always be put next to each other and a story can like emerge between them. Like, it doesn't all have to make sense. And you can create these very powerful emotional experiences when you put like basically like weird things next to each other and ask players to find the connection. The weirder the two things, the weirder the connection will be, but also the more potential kind of for storytelling. And then the other thing was just this idea of accessibility. Like, I really, really wanted to have a game. And partly this is a very personal thing for me, which is I've wanted to run things like D&D in the past or big games. And I personally am really intimidated by having to study 300 or 400 pages and internalize it. And I feel like it's like you're giving me the raw material, not the game. Like me as the GM, I have to turn it into a game, which feels really overwhelming. And so I really wanted to create an experience that would parcel out all of the parts of the game in the right way to different players and at different times. I think this is actually one of the most powerful thing about card-based RPGs. Some of the trend that we're seeing there is that literally putting things on separate cards is also a way of parceling out different parts of the game in time and to different people. And I really wanted to explore that because I wanted to make a game that people could just, you know, take out of the box, pick up, and just 3 hours later, they've totally creeped each other out with their weird campfire story, you know, zone that they made themselves. And that was the impetus. That's what I felt really needed to happen. And also, and I think this is the thing I love about art, right? Part of it too was I just needed it to exist. There was something about the themes of self-destruction and mutation identity that for me, particularly at the time in my life, and actually like even more so in the last 3 years, that I found that I was able to explore through that in a pretty powerful way. There's so much there, man. There's so much. There's so many directions.
There's so...
I'll boil it down to horror, accessibility, and identity are probably like the three things.
I mean, what is character development, right? If not self-destruction of your old self into the creation of a new self, right? And as someone might be listening, like, whoa, so deep, but for real, it's like when you think about who you are today, you created that person by destroying the bits of your past self that you didn't like or that didn't function in society for you or that was getting in the way. So like now this is also potentially an interesting like conversation about character, because I know that a while back Viditya Valetti asked something about like progression systems and how they don't feel like super great to him. And now with this conversation, I'm like, well, what if there was a progression system that you had to remove something from yourself to gain something else, right?
Totally.
And it's almost like deck building in a way, right? You only get 60 cards in a deck. You know, I think, you know, Magic the Gathering can have more than 60, but really an optimal standard deck is 60 cards. You want to maximize.
That's what I have in my spreadsheet, obviously.
Yeah. Have you referenced the Excel sheet I made? Jesus Christ.
On my wall. Anyway,
you only have so much room as a person, mentally, spiritually, physically.
Yeah.
And that changes based on the things you let go of. And it's so fascinating to think about that as self-destruction in a positive way of like almost self-pruning kind of is another maybe way to put it. But it makes me now think about character development in a pretty different way now. And now I want to make a game where you have to get I like deck builders. Like Slay the Spire is a good example
of
something that might be like this.
Oh my God. Slay this, whenever I look at my Steam library and I notice my hours played of Slay the Spire, I feel this sinking feeling.
And then you play again. And then you play some more. Slay the Spire
Correct.
Is good. It's a good example of character progression through destruction, because if your deck is too big, then you can't maximize your strategies, and then that hurts your, you know, when you get to the final boss. I don't want to ruin it for people who haven't played Slay the Spire, but like, yeah, really, really interesting concept about the story of self-destruction, not even in a game sense, but even in a story sense too, of like a character only changes when I was, so real quick, before I get into some other stuff, would you just tell people what the zone is, because we haven't exactly said that yet.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the zone it's a card-based tabletop RPG where you tell the story of a doomed expedition into this weird, mysterious zone. If you've seen Annihilation or, you know, played the Stalker series of games or read Roadside Picnic, it's really that kind of thing. And the way that it plays is that you've got two to five players, and you create these doomed characters each one has an obsession and a phobia and a reason that they just cannot go back out into the world, because every previous expedition to the zone has not come back. So they know it's probably a suicide mission. Why are they doing this? Because it is rumored that there's something at the center of the zone that will grant your deepest wish. And these desperate characters, that is the basically like the last thing that they got going for them. But at the beginning of the game, you pull from a deck of fate cards, lay them over the spiral of locations that make up the zone, and predetermine when each of you is going to become one with the zone. I don't say die because, I mean, basically you die, but essentially that can mean walking off into the forest and becoming one with the trees, or it can mean being, like, horrifyingly torn apart by a radioactive mutant bear, you know?
Great scene.
And the final player makes it to the center and they can ask for their wish, but it's not so easy because all the other players who are now one with the zone will get to come up with a monkey's paw kind of weird ending where the thing you wanted is not necessarily what you think you're going to get. And so that's the experience it's trying to create, this experience of just empowering the players to create their own horrible, horrible fates for their characters and trying to blend that thing I love from horror, which is when you have really horrible, gruesome things that are right next to, like, beautiful, magical things. And sometimes you don't know which one is which. And I say cards, you know, the physical version, it's entirely card-based. The book is just, like, lightweight onboarding. And I've tried to carry that over into the digital version. So if you play a digital version, then you buy the physical version when I eventually, you know, get it out there. You should already know how to play.
Yeah. So for the game, one, beautiful guided experience for sure. We had the designers behind Gem Room Games on, where we talked about a little bit about onboarding and accessibility. And I don't know in reference when this episode will come out in reference to all other episodes.
No,
but
second to last one in the list. I was just listening to it yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it.
Dan, Colley, thanks for being on the show. And Violet as well, little Violet. But I think about, like, what was nice about the guide experience is, one, you explain the game in sort of like an in-narrative way, which is also something I'm thinking about as I write games. There's a game I'm writing called Heed the Call, which is my attempt to take on fighting game mechanics and tabletop them in a non, like, card game competitive fashion, but it is using cards. But I also combine it with the storytelling of, like, a Metroidvania. And what's interesting about, like, Metroidvanias for me is that you don't learn about, like, the backstory of this Herald character, right? And that's what I call the players, is, like, they're called the Heralds because they're here to fuck this whole thing up. That's why they're here. They're the change that this area needed. But you don't know about their backstory. So Heed the Call sort of starts with an onboarding process of, like, character creation as a session. So it's like, if you ever played Kingdom Hearts, or if you've ever played, basically Kingdom Hearts is the big one, where, especially like the first two, where you open up into almost like a tutorial level of, like, hero, far traveler, how do you protect your friends? And you pick, like, one of three starting stats, and then and that's the sort of experience that you go through. And I thought that was a cool way to get a person into the role-playing aspect, because you tell them, like, hey, you enter on scene right now. How do you fight? What special trinkets did you bring with you? Where do you come from that you'll think about while you're out here? You'll never go back there during this game, but it's important that defines who you are. So what I like about your onboarding process is you really walk people through in a narrative way of, like, hey, you're getting a debrief from the general or something like that, and these are also the instructions of the game at the same time. And then even the onboarding process of character creation, as you sort of pick from different prompts. The additional thing that I thought about, there's a book I'm reading called Creating Character Arcs by K.M. Wayland, and in the book it talks about that a character is four things. It says the character has a lie about the world. So in Thor's lie is that might is right sort of thing. And as a part of that lie, there's a ghost that created that lie, something that the character has lost or has been told that has fashioned that lie. So there is, for Thor, it's that his father has always ruled with sort of like an iron fist sort of thing. He's like, oh, my father sort of did it this way too, so that must be the way you become a king, a good king. And, you know, we find out that his father likes the people, and, like, that's just how Thor has internalized it. And then the character wants something. Thor wants to be king, and then but the character also needs something. He needs to learn how to be humble to be a good king in terms of the story that's being told there. So the reason I bring that up is that your game's phobias and obsessions and the broken past that you make up for the characters, I think, also internalize those same character building pieces, which I think are very, very cool and create really potentially dynamic characters. How did you cut, like, I know that Annihilation and the other media touch points that you mentioned were big influences, but, and we talked a little bit about like narrative structure off mic. Did we talk about it in the introduction? Maybe. I don't remember. But
what is but, existence? What is but Mike? What is on what mic? Is what is off mic?
Hello, Mike. Hello, listeners. You're here in the room with us. But so how did you come to like pick these pieces of character creation in the onboarding process? Like, I know that probably went through many iterations, but why did we settle on this last bit here?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. I for me, it was really about asking, and I got to say, this is one of my favorite things about the direction that I'm seeing. A lot of the, basically like the entirely indie, you know, RPG sphere moving towards is, instead of asking, how do we simulate this experience? Mm-hmm. So I feel like the thing that D&D is great at is saying, like, I want to simulate the experience of just going around and punching things or stabbing things or, you know, shooting things with bows or setting them on fire with magic or non-magical means. And there's just enormous amount of mechanical build out for that. And one of the ways you could think about it is you could say, well, here's this world, and these are the things that are going to happen in this world. And so everything in the character sheet then ends up being the set of things you need to correctly simulate. That's almost like the programming of the computer. And I think what I see, I'm very, very inspired by the world of like Hollywood screenwriting, for example, or any kind of screenwriting, you know, novel writing, storytelling, where you start with the character, you figure out what's the experience you kind of want the person watching the movie or reading the book to have. And you start with the character and then build the world based on what does the character need to experience. Because the audience is going to be invested in the characters, the character and characters of the story. You want to take them on this journey. And you can design everything based on that. And so, very similar to what you were describing with character arcs, for me, what I knew was that I wanted the experience of completely self-destroying your character, like having your character go through mutation and annihilation. Right? Mm-hmm. It's to me, the core of this genre is going into a place with some predetermined notions about your identity and having something you don't understand, like literally physically mutate you and change you and make you experience like horrors and wonders beyond your comprehension until you like are turned to dust or whatever it is that ends up happening to you. And so then I asked myself, and this is the UX designer side of me, I asked myself two things, really. What are the things that the players need to be successful at this? And also, what's the limit of information that I can put in front of them that they're actually going to take in? Because mm-hmm. one thing that I noticed in my play of Archipelago, like Archipelago is a very lightweight game, but it has like six moves. And I only remembered like one move.
Mm.
And in my day-to-day as a UX designer, in my career as a UX designer, the thing that has always come back over and over again as a lesson that I've had to learn the hard way over and over again is, even when you think you have a small enough amount of stuff on the page that people can make good choices, you still have too much on the page. And mm-hmm. like that little like graphical element or that, you know, oh yeah, I'm sure I can put an extra button here, it'll be fine, will still, to someone who's kind of coming to it, feel overwhelming. Like I always assume that everything is overwhelming all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are two competing forces. So on the what do people need to be successful, I said to myself, okay, like if they are going to self-destroy their characters, they kind of need to know where their characters are coming from. And so each character has a pre-built kind of narrative, like, you know, you're the soldier, you've done atrocious things in war, and like now you're trying to come to terms with that, or you're the bureaucrat who sent people into the zone for some amount of time. You know, could it be decades? It could be, is it months? Is it years? Do you even remember? Who ran experiments in the local population before you were cut off? And you're looking for absolution, or the writer who just hasn't been able to like write a single word for a decade. You know, so I give people like a little bit of a starting point, but then I ask myself, what are the next little things that people can hook off of? Because there's two things that matter here, too. One of them is you need to know what you want to do to your own character. But also, if you want other players to create worlds and situations that will put your character in situations where they will change, they need to be able to see what's going on with you. Mm-hmm. And so I ask myself, what's the smallest amount of information I can put in a character sheet that will help people answer those questions when they're directing a scene and the scene says, you know, a horrible monster shows up that triggers someone's phobia. They need to be able to really quickly see, hey, everybody, like, tell me what your phobias are again. Whereas if I have a character sheet that has 12 different elements on it, then that'll slow everything down to crawl. Mm-hmm. People won't be able to very quickly ask each other, hey, like, what's that thing that you've got? Mm-hmm. So giving people more ends up actually being less. And the reason I ended up with the obsession and the phobia was because something that was very clear to me at the beginning of the game is I didn't want it to just be like grim, dark horror. Like, I actually think that if you just have horror and you don't have the magic to balance it out, then you end up with a little bit of a one-note experience. Some of the best horror has this kind of sublime thing. Like H.R. Giger's Alien is both like absolutely disgusting, but also kind of beautiful. And so I needed to give people like a positive impetus that the zone could use to tempt them. Mm-hmm. So if your obsession is that you are just looking for inspiration, you're the writer, you're looking for something that'll get that creative spark going, then, I mean, I had an experience of the zone a few months back where the zone manifested, it's just a book signing, a really weird fungal book signing that kind of seduced the author into it to give them that sense that they were, that they mattered again, right? So I want the zone to have something to seduce you with. And then I also want to have the zone have something to terrify you with. Mm-hmm. And then the next element on top of that is I want those things to be in the control of the players because, and this is entirely cribbed off of Bluebeard's Bride, but there is nothing scarier than what's already in your own head. Mm-hmm. And so that's why jump scares kind of fall flat for me. So if I give people the framework to opt in to some kind of prompts, because and this comes back to the accessibility question, people are just starting the game out. They don't know what the game's going to be. So if they haven't played before, they might not be able to come up with a good phobia or an obsession the first time around. Or if they kind of know the genre, they want to explore a specific thing, then they can kind of write it into them. And that way, the whole table knows, and this also comes back to safety as well, and to, mm-hmm. to calibration tools, right? To make mm-hmm. sure that you're having the right experience at the table. If I know that when I create a scene that is just full of spiders, that I'm doing that because the character playing the entrepreneur has a terrible phobia of spiders, but that the player who's playing that character really wants to explore that, then we can play pretty hard and everyone's going to be safe and everyone's going to be having, as players, the experience that they want to have. And the characters are also going to be encountering the horrors that are going to push them to new heights. Mm-hmm. And I'll say one last thing, which is there's also the idea of the broken life. And there's a reason that there's no prompts there. It's just that's one part of the character sheet that you actually have to fill out. Mm-hmm. And that's a trick from UX facilitation where when you ask someone to think about something, you are guiding them in a certain way. Like questions aren't, so even the question, what are you most afraid of at the beginning of a TTRPG is going to guide the game in that direction. Mm-hmm. I was looking at, you know, I really love Jian Shim, just makes the most incredible games. I know her, and I was looking at the beta of the Witch's Cottage that she just posted, and she has this question in it. You have a small livestock. What individual did you, not the witch, rear from infancy? What did you name it, and what is your relationship with it like? And I'm like, Okay. It's going to die. It's going to get sacrificed. Yeah. I just know, you know? So questions are neutral. And so if I ask you to think about what is this character's broken life, then I'm putting you in the mindset of the character who has chosen to go on a mission. They probably are not going to... There's no evidence they're going to be able to come back from this mission. And I want people to confront that so that they are also thinking about why would you do that, mm-hmm. to raise mm-hmm. the stakes and make it so that when you get to the center, there's as good a chance as possible that you're going to ask a really juicy question of the zone, which is all the other players. So it all loops around. And I think a lot about how can a single question have many, many purposes. And there were more questions in earlier versions of the game and different ones. And I just tried really hard to collapse it down. And I'll just say one last thing. I feel like if there's a lot to say about every part of this. So just stop me. Stop me if you need to.
I can't. The show doesn't allow it.
Excellent. The other restriction, and this was inspired by, this is a game that Jason Morningstar and Randy Lubin made called Honor Bound. The character sheets in LARP have to be small enough that you can carry them around with you. Mm-hmm. And I love that creative restriction, because if I could imagine the ideal place where someone could play the zone, it would be just like around a campfire. Mm-hmm. And I haven't solved for the fact that that would mean all the cards in the center would be immediately incinerated. You know, maybe the premium Kickstarter tier will have fireproof cards. We'll see. Just covered in Nomex. But anyway, I had that creative restriction for myself of like, I want the character sheets to be small enough that you can hold them. And then I also want them to be for you to be able to like flip them inside out when you die, so that you still end up with a little booklet. But now you've got the flipped inside out. You are dead. Here are the moves you can do booklet. Mm-hmm. And so, again, that was like, well, I've only got space for three questions. And that was really clarifying, actually. Mm-hmm. Really, really helpful. So it comes back to UX design question of what's the information I want you to see on the inside of your booklet. And when you put your booklet on the table, there's questions that the shorter version of those questions, the instruction is like, write in really big letters the one word version of your phobia and your obsession so that other players can see it from across the table. So it's all like the UX design, the communication design that ends up driving like what I limit myself to in that mm-hmm. UX. And then in the game, in the digital version, it's kind of the same thing. If I keep it really pithy and kind of short, then I can reuse it in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I have like 100 different things, then I get confused. That's really the short answer to all of this is because I would personally get confused as the game designer if there was more stuff to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, we end up designing the game that we want to play. So, you know, there's truth to that. Yeah, I think that's something I'm struggling with in a lot of my designs is that they end up bloating real hard. Like as I continue to write, like I had an idea for a Devil May Cry, like action thing where it has like a step die system. And then that got really blown. Like, okay, I need to kick this to the can right now. Cause I can't even parse like what I want to do here. And then I had another game that was a combination of like a game called Drifter by Andreas Walters and Metal Weave Games, where it takes Hyperlight Drifter and turns that into a tabletop game.
That's a very gorgeous cool. game. That's such a gorgeous game.
It's so good. Oh my God. Love it. Yeah, definitely a big fan of like... I'm a big fan of the games that let you assemble their narrative. Like Hyperlight Drifter is like this. Dark Souls is like this. Hollow Knight is like this. Even Metroid Prime, like the early Metroid Primes are like this. Like why is Samus even here on this planet? Like I know that she's a bounty hunter, but like... Why was Ripley created? All those sorts of things.
So with but, you. And also that kind of emergent narrative where like it doesn't actually explain everything. Some of it's just, this is just in the world. You just mm-hmm. kind of, it's implied by the things that you run into and these weird characters and it doesn't feel the need to spell it all out because you're just mm-hmm. bathed in it. You're just experiencing it.
Yeah. And I love when a story lets you theory craft. Like I love where like, what if the knight... Like, I love the theory that the knight is actually the old pale king, just reincarnated. Like, that's one of my favorite theories. It's just this endless loop that happens over and over and over again is like the bug's life, right? Like, the conspiracy theory goes so deep. It's like, did Team Cherry mean to do this?
Theory crafting, like, headcanons. I'm obsessed with all that.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Have you seen Snowpiercer?
Yeah.
Have you seen Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?
Yes, and the thing that they're linked. Yeah.
Have you seen the theory?
Yeah.
I love that stuff. I think headcanon just makes all of these things so much better.
And that's practices in like stratagems and tactics and connections and all those things. But to bring it back to the zone, yeah, I really love how this game gives you. So I played halfway through a solo version because eventually I got tired of being the director every single time and I was like, damn it, I need friends. But I picked the writer. I picked that
Jeremy, if you want to play a game, like I will gladly play a game with you and grab a couple of other people. I think that would be really fun.
Yes, let's do it. I picked the writer. I chose that I wanted the Pulitzer Prize. I'm trying to remember from yesterday, the Pulitzer Prize, and I hated Dr. Fitzgald, I think is the name.
D. Fitzbaker, your nemesis.
D. Fitzbaker. Yeah, so I chose my nemesis, and I chose that I wanted a Pulitzer Prize, and then in the fill-in prompt for the broken life, I said, or broken past, I said that I don't want to live in his shadow anymore. I cannot leave this place without findings. And I was obsessed with like ancient language, basically. So I thought, I was like, okay, maybe there's like alien scriptures, this is some Aztec-ish or like that sort of thing. So my whole drive for continuing to the zone is like, I can't go back because my back life is that I'm second barrel. I'm always going to live in this guy's shadow until I find something that he himself wasn't willing to do. And that's what will push me forward into the zone. So what I liked about that experience is that you have to, and what I similarly felt about Heed the Call is that I think where D&D falls flat for me in terms of character creation is that it doesn't tell you what your goal is. Yeah. It never gives you a reason to fight the dragon, right? Do you fight the dragon to protect the people? Sure, that's a reason, but oftentimes it's not what it sets up for you. And that's sort of like, oh, that's obvious. And then everyone's trying to like figure out what their story is 20 sessions later. And then they finally decide to like, oh, this is why I'm a part of this adventuring party, right? So I think what's more powerful and again helps the onboarding process is to say like, this is why you're doing this narratively, and you have to play into that. Like, you have to take the conceit that I'm here to find answers for a Nobel Prize, and I'm here to get to the center of this place and get my wish granted so that when I go back, I have a good life. But me as the player knows that when I reach the center, or if I reach the center, as long as I'm in the zone, I'm gone. I'm donezos. I'm turning into a eternal scriber who writes the stories of everyone else who comes into the zone. I am a desk. Actually, now that I say it out loud, I now imagine myself as a desk that people are forced to sit at, and then they're just journaling until they turn into skeletons, and then I'm just a pile of desk skeletons.
That's so sick. I love it so much. You have no idea how much I love hearing the stories that people come up. Because people, they go on this journey. They're like, okay, well, if I really wanted this more than life itself, yeah, what would I become? And it just gets so weird so quickly.
So Lovecraftian in a way, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing I really like about the zone, and that you sort of touched on when you were talking about that players become a part of the zone as they begin to decease or transform, destruct, annihilate, is the concept of like post-elimination mechanics. So I had another guest that hasn't come out yet, but his name is Andy Burdan. He wrote a game called Mic Drop, and we talked a little bit about like post-elimination mechanics, about how games like One Night Werewolf isn't particularly fun when you're eliminated, and then you have to wait for the game to finish before you play again.
Yeah, you're
right?
Just twiddling your fingers.
It's boring. It's super boring, and like, this, I'm sure someone's like, but the fun is in watching like the werewolf be discovered. I don't think so. Have you actually played a game of werewolf where you like didn't make it, like you were the first to die? not a great time. Where in contrast, there's another social deduction game that I really like called Blood Under the Clock Tower.
I don't know.
Or, I'm sorry, Blood on the Clock Tower. What was that?
I don't know that one.
Yeah, a really great game. Highly recommend it. Basically, similar vibes. Everyone has a role. You have to find out who the demon is. And then when you find the demon, you win the game. And if you don't find the demon, you don't win the game. Or the demon wins the game. So it's competitive. But the two pieces of post-elimination mechanic, or three pieces, actually. Some roles only trigger their abilities when they die under certain circumstances. Everyone is allowed to continue to talk about clues of the game as if you're like a ghost or something like that to influence the other players. So if like you're a minion helping the bad team, you can still continue to spread misinformation as you talk about the game. And then when you die, you get to hold on to one final vote. Like, it's the narrative, like, oh, I spelled out the name of the murderer in blood, or I'm pointing in some, like, secret door direction that no one's discovered yet. And it's, like, that sort of narrative. But you get this one final vote as a ghost that you can save for any point of the game, which could help everyone additionally. And even if you vote, you still continue to get to play and produce information. Whereas in, like, Werewolf, you're sort of encouraged not to speak anymore once you're removed from the game. So I think with this post-elimination mechanic, thinking about, like, now you become the zone. If your character dies, you now become the zone. Whereas in contrast to D&D, is like, once you die, you have to make a new character. Right. Unless, you know, resurrection or whatever that looks like, and that sort of emergent storytelling. But the post-elimination mechanic is long, like, in between. There's a long, stagnant pause of, like, I have to create the character, or the team has to figure out how to get me revived in a short amount of time. And then you're, like, and that also comes at the expense of, like, nuanced hand-waving, like, oh, you can get to the church in the very next scene and do that whole thing as well. But those are all things that you have to sort of, like, labor into it, whereas the zone provides it, like, in mechanic, which is great.
Yeah, that's very intentional, and there's a few things there that are worth kind of poking out from a design perspective. Mm-hmm. So one is, just in general, I think the beauty of play-to-lose games in general is that they don't need to be balanced. I mean, mm-hmm. sounds like we are both into roguelikes.
Yeah.
I
love the pain.
In 2020, I put like 700 hours into Spelunky 2, for example. I don't know if you've played it, but...
yeah.
It's absolutely, it's a brutal game. You know, when you first start playing, like, your runs last 15 seconds. You immediately, like, jump on a bat and fall on some spikes and die. And the beauty of that, and, like, for example, Slay the Spire, I think, is such a great example of a game that really understands its medium, because one game you play, you die, like, three levels in, and you get, you know, eaten by a mouse or whatever was, like, first level enemies. And then another game, you might get, you know, the poison that you can throw at other at your enemies, and the card that doubles damage that then you multiply by you enhance to make it triple damage, and so on and so on, until you're just like chewing your way through the
discovering those synergies.
And it feels really good. And I think play-to-lose games have this that same kind of vibe in RPGs, where instead of having to play this kind of balanced experience of trying to come up with an encounter, like the dragon has to match the skills of the players. Mm-hmm. And like, I saw this thread on Twitter that made me cry. It was like, how many of you GMs have accidentally killed your players? And I'm like, that's so sad, you know, like, the idea that you could just play an RPG and have to, and just like accidentally kill everyone just because the game is set up in such a way that you actually have to get balance right and think about these things. Like, that's not what it's cool, but it's not nothing to do with story. So when you play to lose, you can basically just go right into the most gonzo weird situations, knowing that the game will support you and convert your irresponsible actions into cool stuff. So that's why, you know, in the zone, like, core mechanic is not so easy cards, where every time you try and do something hard, you get a not so easy card, and not so easy cards are how you mutate, and the game incentivizes you to get not so easy cards because that gives you agency later when you are the zone over the fate of the final player if you need mechanical incentives. But really, it's because the point of the game is that it's kind of fun to describe mutation. It's just fun. It's kind of neat. Everyone loves doing it, particularly to their own characters. This is also why you choose your own mutation instead of rolling it on a table and having it done to you. Mm-hmm. Because what I want people to channel is that creative energy of, oh yeah, I can mutate my own. I get to decide. Cool. Okay, they turn into, you know. Oh, shit.
I have to write you.
Yeah.
You gave me game idea.
Write it down.
You gave me game juice.
I got to be real with you, man.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural materials, like leather made from plants, eucalyptus tree fiber, and sugarcane. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're supernatural. Find your perfect pair at allbirds.com today. That's allbirds.com.
Any conversation that causes a game idea to happen, I'm like, I'm good. We succeeded.
Yeah, we did it.
So yeah, that's one thing. That's one thing about Play to Lose that I find really, really thrilling. And so then you ask yourself, okay, if I want people to have that experience, how do I support them? And I think this is another thing that comes from my, you know, background as a UX designer, is basically saying, I can't ask people to do something unless I support them and give them the tools to do it. It's without a GM to really guide the experience, the game has to guide itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the paper version guides itself to some extent, like the digital version really guides itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that final incentive of, if you play the zone, your choices will matter, so you're still paying attention because you're going to have to decide stuff, is one thing. Roguelikes are inspiring in so many ways, but one thing that's important there is thinking about pacing. So mm-hmm. I can probably ask people to not pay attention, to like be the zone for the last like 35 minutes of the game. If it's 2 hours, then that might be a little bit thin. Mm-hmm. Even though they're still playing the director, like the reality is that you do lose a little bit of investment when your character dies, but it's more than made up for by the fact that you're now able to fully focus on the experiences of the other players who are still there. And I've noticed there's this thing that happens. I kind of call it the attentional campfire, where you know that thing where like you walk down the street, someone's looking up.
Mm-hmm.
And you go like this, you look up as well. And then if there's two people looking up, third person walks up, they look up too. And before you know it, there's 50 people looking up and there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
It's, we cue into what other people are paying attention to. And so this is maybe like a secret design thing I'm doing here, which is, if there are players whose only thing they can pay attention to is the story being told, that turns the final players into an attentional campfire, where just the fact that everyone is paying attention to them makes them more epic. And you really feel it at the table. you feel that shift as people die. And it's all a balance, you know, it's all a balance. I'm kind of committed in an undying level to making play to lose games. Like pretty much every game I make is play to lose because of that.
Yeah. There is what's interesting about play to lose. And it's almost like when we think about the GM sort of riffing off of that. Because one thing to mention about Blood Under the Clock Tower is that it does require a GM. You need someone who can sort of like operate the room and facilitate the roles, powers in the night and stuff. Or during the trickery phase, which is what I call the night phases for games. But it's interesting that it's almost like a... Because the director is like a GM full style design, right? Or GM less, or whatever version of that spectrum you want to call that. But then there's also the secondary sort of concept that's like GM growth, or maybe a growth's not the right word, but like you're gaining the role of GM over the course of the game by becoming the zone, right? I don't know how to codify that in like a simple term, but or jargon or whatever, but it's really fascinating that that's sort of the shape the game takes on, is that you will grow into the GM role as the game progresses, especially with more mutates and stuff. And then you may get the player that's like, ooh, cool, I want to try and like build as many mutates as possible because I want to have some like good authority over the course of the game. So I want to get to like the what is it, the library or the office? Like I want to get to at least the office so that when the final center is happening, like
those locations are totally random, by the way. So every game is different.
Heard.
I really like it's. There's a lot of roguelike inspiration there. Every time you create a new game, the cards create a different zone.
I love emergent like map building for sure. Like that's why I really like Iron Sworn a ton, is that it has those emergent space, like gives you boxes, but also gives you like tags and things to add to the games. Is your desk slowly lowering?
It's lowering. It's lowering. My legs got tired.
That's super. I was like, is the camera an AI? Do you have a robot behind you?
Am I a robot? This is what a year of work from home will like get you to do.
Yeah, I love it. I need it. I want a robot that helps me. Siri, turn yourself into... Anyways, don't respond to me. But yeah, it's. I think it's a fascinating concept about like a game that has a GM growth mechanic, in that if you're the kind of person is okay with watching things unfold, maybe you take less mutates. Like maybe you kind of position yourself to... I'll exit after like card three, like map card three or whatever. And maybe you're the person like, ooh, I really have some good ideas. I want to get to like card six. And then, you know, we'll talk about what my character looks like at that time. So I think it's really fascinating about like a GM growth tech that's here in present. I think there are other games that maybe also do this too. Maybe it's like things like Flashbacks or Offerings and Blades in the Dark that sort of have like a GM growth sort of thing there, because they're like imagining the narrative moving forward with like flashbacks and things. Yeah, GM growth. Interesting.
That's, you know, it's really inspiring for me to hear you say that, because that's not an angle I'd specifically thought about there, because I'm so in like, you don't need a GM land. I also really, you know, I love games that are GM'd, and I think GMing is like its own like amazing art form. And thinking about the progression of games that'll turn you into the GM that you want to be, instead of it being like either you're GMing or you're not. I played Ban of Blades with Randy and some other friends. Yeah, like really well, just so much depth there. And I was actually pretty... I struggle with deep mechanical games because my brain just like doesn't work that way. Like this is why I think like the whole like D&D style combat, I love it in a computer game context, because there I can just think about what I want to do. But if I'm running it, then I'm constantly having to think about mechanics versus the story, and it's a little bit overwhelming until you've done it a bunch of times.
You have to be the scripted programming.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone else gets to just operate the programming.
And that bums me out, because I want computers to do the things that computers are amazing at, and people to do the things that people are amazing at. And so that and that's what's so exciting about all these kind of new platforms coming out. But Randy is like a mechanical genius, and so we were like, okay, I'll be the mechanics GM, he said, and I'll be the story. And that was really cool. But by the end of the first session, I'd picked up enough of the mechanics that he was able to kind of fully transfer that over to me. Mm-hmm. So I love that. I love that idea of thinking about how do you get people into a place where they are going to be able to succeed, mm-hmm. and, you know, meet them where they are instead of just giving them a tome. Another mm-hmm. good example of this is Star Wars Edge of the Empire mm-hmm. Has this quick start first game you can play, and it literally has like box out. If players do this, as the GM, read this out. If players do this, box out. As the GM, read this out. So it walks you through every single step of that first kind of setting as the GM. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of scripted. It's on the rails. It really is that kind of, you know, JRPG style. Like, I've been playing for 3 hours and the game tells you, and now the tutorial is over.
Yeah.
Like, what?
I knew how to cast fire from day one. I was there when the scriptures were written.
700 hours in. Tutorial now over. You can now enter the real world.
And isn't that just life, right? You hit 18 and the tutorial stage is over.
I am pretty sure that the tutorial stage of life never ends.
Never. But another good comparison is when you think about like putting people in places they want to be. I also think about like business, right? Like jobs, careers.
Same
like
thing.
There's so many, like in my experience, I've seen so many instances of people being like, a square block being forced into a round hole because they just need that spot filled by anyone. And that person's not happy with what they're doing. They don't feel fulfilled. They don't feel like they're exercising their autonomy in a way that feels satisfying to them. And like, instead, why don't you just talk to a person? Like, I remember having a conversation with an old friend about how she was running a grocery store. And one of her employees is on the phone all the time, doesn't really engage with customers, hangs out at the register a bunch, but she loves driving. Like, she loves making the delivery trips. And she also talked about how she wanted to expand like delivery jobs. Like, oh, okay, cool. So instead of having that person on the register, why don't you just let them be your delivery person? And it's like, I just don't know why that's not more obvious when it comes to like working with other human beings and like trying to just fill holes. And I think this happens more at like, this is my intuitions and my personal opinion coming from a jaded restaurant working experience. But I feel like it's more of like blue collar jobs that just say like, I want a warm body here to fill this menial task so that my job can continue or my business can continue to function and I can continue to rake in whatever dollars I'm raking in or whatever. And then yell at those people when they don't operate at full capacity because that's not what they want to do. So,
dude, like this is just a massive tangent, but I think, yeah, I saw this document go by yesterday on that was a white supremacist analysis of capitalism and was just looking at how some of these value systems around the things that you're describing, like, they're just so baked deep into the culture. It's funny, like, I studied economics before becoming a designer, and economics, the kind of founding myth of modern economics is Adam Smith and the pin factory and the idea of, like, instead of having this one artisan making pins, you could specialize and have a production line with 18 different people doing the same task a bunch of times. And then, like, you know, turn of the 1900s, you've got Taylorism and scientific management, right? This whole idea of, as a manager, I can measure people's output, which all started with measuring people producing steel bars. But then, like, 50 years later, you start seeing it applied to everything and to, like, knowledge work as well, to, like, the fuzzier things. And now it's, like, metastasized into this, like, horrifying gig economy where, like, Amazon workers, like, running around peeing in bottles because the machine is black mirroring them into an algorithm. Mm-hmm. Just to, like, massively oversimplify the hundreds of years of evolution. But, like, I do think there's a cognitive style there of people as resources, which I would love to replace with a cognitive style of, hey, like, people are, like, amazing creative individuals, and how do we create a society that nurtures everyone, like, at whatever level they're at, just, like, help them, support them, take them wherever they want to go, you know? That should be, like, the principle of designing all of society. Huge tangent from TTRPG design.
Yeah. But, find the utopia. And isn't every utopia just a dystopia for someone else? But, anyways.
You know, it's funny because like, it is one of the crushing things about being a game designer and a designer is you're just like, you spend all your time thinking, how can I create the best experience for people? And you just want the whole world to work that way, you know?
But everyone should think like this.
Let's support each other. It's a bushy-tailed raft just being a utopian optimist.
Amazing. Any other... This has felt like 25 minutes, but we're at an hour and a half at this exact stage. And we have two lightning rounds to get to. Is there anything else you want to add as a part of the zone conversation?
I just want to say, like, I'm just excited. Like, I feel like I'm part of... I just feel like I'm part of, like, this huge community of people who are just asking themselves, how can we design games that are more accessible in, like, every sense of the word? And it's just exciting. It's just exciting to see that direction and see people breaking down, like, all the types of accessibility, right? Mm-hmm. Like, from, you know, economic accessibility and race and neurodivergence to also just, like, the accessibility of, like, how long have you been playing games in the first place? And, yeah, I just want to express my, like, undying kind of love and admiration for the fact that I know there's so many game designers working on this right now. And that was a big thing for me in the zone. And it's just been a really cool thing to get to play around with.
Awesome. What a beautiful note to end. First one being Raf. Trends. What's up with those? So are there any trends that you're seeing in your social circles that are really like pinging on you over and over again? They're like, oh, I love that this person and this person and this person are all working on this similar trend. Are there any trends within yourself that you want to speak into the ether that you want, like you would love for someone else to run with? Are there any trends that you feel are being detractive or subtractive from the industry that you want to caution people against? Like, don't believe the hype that it is sort of thing.
I like that. That last one's like, give me that hot take question.
Yeah. I mean,
time for
here's
hot
the thing.
Take, podcast hot take.
Just I don't want, everyone's really scared because it feels like an opening to a dunk session, and that's, you know, the only two things I dunk on super hard on this show are D&D and Critical Role, and that I don't think I'll be able to let that go. But this, you know, I'm not trying to foster a space where we can talk negatively about someone, but it's things like, you know, someone pushing back against the idea of bioessentialism, right? Like,
totally.
Yeah, it's those sorts of conversations that need, or like, how people like to break the illusions of like massively successful Kickstarters that already had opening money. And, you know, it was the whole thing with, oh shit, what was the game? The Quest guy, Quest RPG.
Oh yeah. Totally.
That did like the Zine Quest stuff and was like, but that's not what like the culture is about. And you're asking for like hundreds of thousands of dollars, dude. Like, God damn it. And just sort of like tainting that sort of pure experience. So yeah, anyways, trends, anything that's on your radar.
Well, and I'm right there with you, by the way. Like, I personally have like a no dunk rule.
Yeah.
Where I just think, I was just listening to, there's a podcast I love, which is like the Craig Mazin and I forget the second guy, but Script Notes. Craig Mazin's guy, he's the screenwriter for Chernobyl. And they are 500 episodes into this podcast. It's astonishing. Wow. It's just like an hour a week of screenwriting advice. And they were talking about how much critics suck. Because you ever heard that Ira Glass quote about how we get into a creative universe or creative profession because we got taste. We see a movie or we see a game and we think, man, like, I love this. It's given me ideas. I think I can make something here. And you feel like you have enough taste that you can create in this space, but your skill level is way lower than your taste for a long time. Mm-hmm. And our glass calls this the gap, where in that gap you're trying to catch up to your taste, and your taste is also getting better the more you do it, so it's like it's running away from you. And the most important thing you can do is just keep going, just don't stop. Mm-hmm. You know, because you'll get there. And I feel like dunking and and criticism, not critique, but criticism.
Mm-hmm.
I always want to assume that everyone is, I just want everyone to feel like they are supported in overcoming that gap. And dunking just never gets you there because you don't know where someone's coming from. They didn't ask for your criticism. And in any way, dunking, particularly if you're on a personal level, you're just kind of being a dick. Just don't do that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a long game. Play the infinite game.
Play the
the
beyond the long game. Yeah. The beyond a control deck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I do want to connect it to a trend too, which is I think that the... So that's a criticism, and dunking is really bad. And growth and improvement comes from critique and from structured knowing how to ask for feedback in the right way and also knowing how to, you know, receive feedback. Like over like 100, you know, humans played the zone. And this is where, like, I'm, as a UX designer, being able to bring my practice of knowing how to run a playtest and how to get feedback in the right way really helped me to make the game better because, you know, sometimes a playtest is brutal and there is a skill in kind of knowing how to turn that into like useful critique in a design sense, or like criticism is, I think this sucks. Critique is, I understand the goals of what you're trying to do. And I think you're not hitting these goals in this way, this way, and this way. And I can't remember who said this, but if someone tells you about their experience, believe them. If they tell you how to fix it, never believe them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the golden rule of playtesting. And so I think that's where I would go in terms of like the last question you asked, where I think that Twitter is a horrible environment for all of this. Like all of social media is a horrible environment for this. Discord's a little bit better. But one trend I think that I'm kind of excited about, and that I'm also like I want to, you know, write more about and help kind of support people in this is like, how do we get better as a community balancing that desire to support each other with also that the, you know, the skill of playtesting, the skill of critiquing each other in a way that is consensual, where like you're not dunking on someone, you're not just giving unsolicited advice, but as a community, we'd level each other up. Like, you know, essentially like it's pointing out that you have salad in your teeth. Like, I want people to critique the zone, but it's my job as a game designer to create the environment for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the environment, the social media environments we're interacting with are just like super toxic to that. So also realizing the water we're swimming in is toxic.
Mm-hmm.
I do have to give a plug for example, like the Tabletop Call-In Show. I cannot tell you how much I love that you and Adam are creating this structure. Because to me, like, that's the beginning of like knitting together the community in like a slightly different way than just, hey, we're just tweeting at each other.
Mm-hmm. yeah.
So I love seeing those kinds of spaces. Like, that's a trend that I think is really cool. Like, just better, more humane social spaces where we can like get to know each other and really like bring the community together. I think the other really obvious trend is just like web stuff, right? You know? How things are moving onto the web. It's we're just scratching the surface. There's so many things to talk about there. I will call out just one specific thing, which is the concept in design called skeuomorphism. I'll just define it for folks because I hate bringing jargon into any kind of conversation. But skeuomorphism is, you remember like the first iPhone, you go to like the calendar app and the notes app, there'd be like the little torn paper at the top and there's a little fabric background. It kind of looks like pages. So skeuomorphism is basically when you design something and you are bringing in the cues from a, like, say, the physical version of something into the digital version, even though those aren't necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So skeuomorphism is any time that you're basically saying, I'm going to, like, teach you how to use something by making it look like something you're familiar with. Like the Notes app, it looks like a notepad. If you start a new note, it kind of flips a new page, that kind of thing. And it's good in small doses because it gives people enough information to kind of get started. But in the long run, it's the kind of thing that it kind of gets in the way, or it can be kind of weird. Like on my mic right now, there's a dial that I turn because it's easy to turn stuff with my fingers. But in a web UI or like a computer UI, turning a dial is super hard. You got your mouse, you're like rotating.
God.
It's like... That's a good example, like bad skeuomorphism. It's like, no, it's not native to the thing you're doing.
Mm.
And so right now we're in this skeuomorphism land with virtual tabletops, where basically what they're doing is they're saying, let's take the thing you're doing in the real world and we'll just exactly copy it to the computer world. Mm-hmm. So that's for like Roll20, Tabletopia, Tabletop Simulator are replicating the fiddliness of like moving cards around a table. And that's a great first step. That's a skeuomorphic first step. The first iPhone had all of that because you needed it to get people accustomed to this new world.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just the first step. And I'll just say, when I was building the Zone, the first month, I built a virtual tabletop. Like, I'll show it to you if you want. Like, you know, you could drag the cards around. You could, there were like cool particle effects when you dropped a card on the table. And like, mm-hmm. When you picked up the card, it did that Hearthstone. Like, it would like follow the mouse around and it would kind of like rotate in cool little ways and stuff like that. And I built it and I kind of did my first like pseudo play test with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that basically every single, except one place where at the end of the game you have to like give not so easy cards to someone else, every single interaction with the table where I could freeform pick up a card and put it somewhere else would break the game.
Oh God.
Right? Like, and I mean that in literal sense, it's like you set up the spiral at the beginning of mm-hmm. location cards. If I give you the ability to pick up a location card and put it somewhere else than in the spiral, you broke the game.
Yeah, yeah.
If I let you like freeform pick up a card from a deck and then it's just now on the table, it's just a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, oh crap, like, you know, threw that all away and started again because realized that like the cards are actually just a means to an end. What the cards mm-hmm. are doing is they're saying, I want to have a sequence of locations that you go through one by one. At each part, you can ask certain questions. You guide the players. You tell them who's the director. They can draw cards in certain decks. But decks are just a way of saying, I want to have a stack of information in a certain order that's yep. shuffled. The deck's just like the skeuomorphic way of doing it. It's like in the real world, do that with paper. The digital world, what's the right way to do it? Well, it's a different way. Mm-hmm. And so I am right now, there's this huge barrier to entry where there's a lot of folks in the community who are like me, who like know how to code. Like, there's like a surprising number, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a pretty high barrier to entry because it's a lot of work to learn how to make software.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, like layouts have a high barrier to entry. So mm-hmm. I just know that I see like the 20-year-olds who are making like insanely awesome games on itch. And I'm like, you can learn to do everything I can do like 10 times the speed because your brain is operating like your galaxy braining. And I already feel like I'm just like decrepit, you know. But I think it's those folks who are kind of going to create that next generation. That's what I'm trying to explore with the Zone. Mm-hmm. I think the Zone is in this weird place where I'm able to do it because I already have these skills. And I'm hoping that the next step is going to be people building tools like, you know, Randy Lubin's building StorySynth, for example, mm-hmm. but building tools that make it possible for people with like less of this like technical background to build experiences that are native to being online and playing online that are not just trying to like take the physical thing and make a worse version of it
mm-hmm.
with weird card physics where you like you move it like a pixel that like flies off the table into foreverness. That's probably the second. That's the trend that I'm most excited about from like a mechanics perspective.
And again, I think it's full circle, this idea of self-destruction or removal, character growth. It's like, I feel like there's a...
Yeah.
When you talk about that skeuomorphism, it's the sense of like traditionalism where, oh, cards look and feel like this. And so that's how they must look and feel at all times when they're being engaged. And that's not necessarily true. Like it's also the difference of like rolling dice physically and doing a number generator, right? Like,
yeah.
Why? I know that people, or I've heard people complain about like, oh, a random number generator isn't that random, and like, well, neither is like a dice, a piece of plastic dice with holes in it, because one side is heavier than the other. Like, it's yeah. not truly random. And fun fact, everyone: if you consider the number that's on a side of a dice, or the number of pips, whether that be a hole or paint, one side is heavier than the other by micrograms. And like, it's not even chances no matter which way you cut it. So is it to a 0.1000th that that you actually give a damn? No. You know what I mean? Like, there's no reason to care about that. But I'm just saying, a random number generator is fine, as well as the dice.
No, Jeremy, like the only thing computers are good at is we can finally simulate dice that have the same weight on every side. Yeah. That's it. That's the only thing.
Blank dice.
The perfect blank. D20.
Blank perfect dice. Perfect. Also, the D20 is the worst probability dice because the faces aren't even. I watched a too long video about polyhedral sides, and I know a little too much.
You have to send this. I have to watch this. I have this. My mind works entirely in memes, but my mental image is Ash from Alien. You know, and when he's like, it's the perfect organism, but across from him isn't a xenomorph. It's a perfect D20 space. Simulated to inch, a micron.
Amazing. I'm going to put a panning effect here. But yeah, the direction one, to quote on like the dunk culture thing, is like, I totally agree. I think there's a growth in skill that needs to happen when it comes to listening and then being able to parse information in a way that's not, I don't want to say aggressive, because I don't think that's quite the right feeling of it, but more in the sense of like, to understand that we are both talking about the problem, not the individual who created the problem, right? Like, how do we solve the problem, not the individual? Because I think that's where it goes a lot of the time. Like, you as an individual are the problem of this game, and that's not true. And I think, I actually wrote it down here. The thing that I think is most harmful to this sort of like criticism, not critique, infrastructure is like comments, like sites that put comments on things. Like,
never
when we talk about, I hate it. Like, I would be cool if a site didn't have... Well, here's the thing. A lot of people, a lot of consumers use reviews as a way to get a product. Like, oh, cool, enough people have, like, given this a thumbs up. It must be good. Like, there's been enough testing behind it or enough consumer response to it, right? And I think, to some extent, that's helpful. But the thing about like comments, and like when I think specifically about like Itch, right? When someone's on there, it's like, hey, where's the game in this? There's only a page here, and I paid $8 for that, and that's not even terribly too much. Like, let's talk about the polishing that went into that single page product. Anyways, that's a whole nother.
Your one Starbucks grande mocha's worth of.
Don't even get me started. Yeah. But yeah, like comment section, Twitter, like, I just don't feel like those are the avenues to engage with reviewing a product, and they don't create good ecosystems for critiquing. I think it has to be, and I think there is also a skill, like you said, that developers, creators, designers also need a way to like, this is the information I'm asking for. I'm not asking for what you think of the game as a whole. Right now I'm in the phase of like, how is combat? Do you feel like combat works? Yeah. Does it elicit these feelings? Yeah. What are you feeling when combat is happening? Like, those are the important questions I want answered this month, this week, whatever have you. And then that's where I'll go in and I'll just do the consumer feedback, because if that's the direction you want your business or design to go to, and that it's sellable for a wider demographic, you need that input to be realistic about it in our current capitalistic landscape. But yeah, it's just something where we have to get away from talking about the consumption of product in a wide format. But then again, I don't know. It's like a catch-22, because it's also a way, it's also a marketing tactic to have people talk about your product, whether it's discourse or not. And that's unfortunate. What have I read? It's like, someone was talking about, like, if you want to be successful in social media, like, you have to engage in discourse, because that's how you get viral. Like, those sorts of, like, discourse moments are viral moments. But then there's also, like, I push back against that, because in, like, well, when someone produces something really helpful, that's also viral. Like, someone who comes up with, like, an idea that's just so, like, universally resonant and clarifying for people, they're like, oh, wow, this helped me make a lot of sense of something. Like, when I think about reductive story structures like Save the Cat and the Hero's Journey, that was my first step into parsing out, like, okay, what is like the through line for this whole thing. Because before that, I never understood how a story operated, right? And then it's up to me as a creator to be like, okay, there are like some things about this that are helpful. And I think there are better clarifications for like creating a story, like the ghost and lies and stuff I talked about earlier in the episode. So I think those are really, really nice trends to talk about here. I think they're really eye-opening.
I just want to riff off that, because I think there's a thing there too, which is something I think about a lot is again, like, when are people set up to succeed and when people are set up to fail? And, you know, I'm just very sensitive to, if I see a bad interaction on the internet or something, like, that first question I'm asking myself is, okay, assume good intent. Obviously, the internet is full of Nazis and horrible, you know, there's certain things where I'm just like, you're just a terrible person.
Yeah, yeah, you can feel it. Yeah.
But I think in the space of what we're talking about, which is like essentially a bunch of people who care about games and aren't trying to abuse each other, but end up having bad interactions, I ask myself, well, what's causing that? And I think it's really important to realize when kind of like it's not your fault. It's kind of the environment of Twitter and of social media, which incentivizes hot takes and rage and you know, the all of you, like, a lie travels around the world, you know, before the truth can catch up, or, you know, all the research and how, like, Facebook did this research. They did their own research on this, and they found that posts that had more negative terms or negative, you know, affect, like, got shared more. And I think constantly, I think the power of, like, culture, the power, like, and again, and kudos back to, like, you know, you and, like, other folks who, I really feel like the podcast that we listen to and the people who are hosting Discords, like, the Brain Trust, such, a, like, a lovely space. And I think what y'all are doing is you're facilitating this conversation where the community can start processing all of this and come up with, okay, for us as a culture, like, how do we fight back against that? How do we create norms that we can all feel safe, like, operating by? And, like, with that whole point of, like, dunking or critique, like, I think I want to spread far and wide this notion that before you leave a comment, that your experience is valid of how you experience a piece of art. But if you want your experience, if you want to hurt the creator, sure, just say the nasty thing you want to say. You shouldn't, but that's all that. If you make it about you, then it's a one-sided conversation. If you want to have a dialogue with a creator, if creators want to dialogue with each other, that core skill at the heart of it is first asking yourself, what's this person trying to do? Because if you go to someone, it's like, there's only one PDF and I paid $8 and where's my 299 other pages, then that's valid feedback if the person who made the game is creating the expectation in some way of they are making traditional RPGs that are rendered as 300-page books. Like, probably if you get a D&D book and it arrives and you've got, like, your hard cut. I'm now picturing, like, you know, I got my, like, Von Richten's Guide to Ravenloft, because I'm so excited to see, like, the X card and everything make it into, like, the discourse. You know, like, I'm so glad to see all that stuff make it into, like, all the wonderful people who contributed to that. But if I'd gotten that, and I've got, like, the thick hardcover. Imagine, like, this is my mental image. The hardcover is, like, half an inch thick. And I open the page, like, it's like, boonk. And there's one page between the two hardcovers. Then it would be valid for me to leave a comment on, like, Wizards of the Coast and be like, hey, you've created an expectation that this is the kind of content I'm going to get. And, like, this is not what I'm getting. Or similar things. Again, like, there's... I think the question asked is always, like, what's the most productive, what's the way that of having a conversation that is, and again, this is not about, like, toxicity and abuse. Like, that's a whole different set of techniques you have to bring out. Like, you have to block people, you have to do moderation, you know, that's a huge thing. But in this particular mode of, like, how are you communicating to get the most creative conversation? Like, the two questions that are most important are, how does this conversation strengthen our relationship? You know, how do I have this conversation in a way that will make us better friends or, you know, better, you know, collaborators? And then, like, the second question is, like, how do I understand enough of what you're trying to do to make you to give you feedback that you can use? Because if someone comes to me with the zone and says, hey, like, I tried to run D&D in the zone and it didn't work. And I'm like, thank you for your feedback. I'm like, okay. Yes, there are no...
the pregnant pause.
There's no stat blocks. Where are the stat blocks? But if someone comes to me and says, hey, like, I'm running... Literally, so I'm running D&D, and I kind of wanted to use the zone to generate this, like, really weird environment that, like, my PCs could go explore. And, like, here's a few things that I noticed as I was going that made that, like, a little bit harder than they could have been, that I'm like... Damn, that's awesome. Thank you for your feedback. I really appreciate that. And like, I want to know you. You're like, thank you for your consideration and giving you this feedback in such a lovely and like thoughtful way. And it doesn't mean that the feedback can't be like very, pointed. Some playtests are just absolutely crushing. But some of the best friends I've made in the last few years have been friends I made in like pretty harsh like zone playtest feedback sessions. So I don't know. It's all about vulnerability and just like caring.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I think there is a certain, like, it's not just onus on the other person to communicate things to you as well, but it's also, and everyone's mental capacity, emotional capacity, spiritual capacity is going to be different, but there is something to say about when you put your content out in the world, people are going to have ideas about it. And whether or not you're prepared for negative or positive feedback, you have to understand that people are going to say things about this thing because you have made the intention to share it with them. They're going to have thoughts. And for me, I guess I would much rather receive the honest thoughts of my work rather than like just sharing it with my very close friends. You're like, oh yeah, this is okay. That's not helpful to me. That's not going to help me improve or take on different perspectives. And I think it's a two-way street here in that you also have to build up a tolerance. Not tolerance, because I don't want to make it sound like you don't have to put up walls to criticism or to critiquing, because they, as we defined here today, criticism and critiquing are not the same things. But for critiques, it's, you also be able to, there's a sort of intellect or knowledge or ability to sift through that information. It's like if one person says your combat blows, you're like, oh, okay, well, maybe not. Like, that doesn't tell me anything, but maybe there's something there. But if like 50 people tell you your combat blows, even if it's not like succinct or positive, there might still be something to that information because enough people said like there's something about this that they're not enjoying. And now I have to, like, now this is where I build a form that talks specifically about the combat and like, hey, here are the components of this thing. What's not going right for you, right? Like that sort of stuff. And definitely ask different people, not the people who are already negatively charged towards your combat.
That's so true. It's so true. And look, like, even like in my practice as a UX designer, like my day job, professional day job, like even with a bunch of people who've been through design school or have been practicing this for a while, it still requires intentional design to create the right environment for that stuff. When you have like the meeting where people come in and they present their work, it does take some discipline to say like, to present it in the right way, to give people enough context to know what you were trying to do. So they're judging it based on your goals, not just on their feelings. And it's their intentional design of like communities for us to all, help elevate each other is a thing. And it's really, I mean, I see it happening and it's just really cool.
Oh, well, I think that's a beautiful touch to put off on trends. We're in the last home stretch here, Raph, in our 2 hour plus now interview, which is great. It's only felt like 30 minutes.
You're like, oh my God, every extra minute of editing that I have to do.
Listen, I have automated programs. I don't care about the clipping. I'm fine. I'm so good. And this is also why I timestamp during the episode. So yeah, Raph, special tip here, TLDR. If anyone wants to scrub through and give me that juicy watch to listen time without watch time as well, I don't know where this is going in the future. Listen time.
I stare carefefully at my podcast. So I'm listening to it.
Same.
I'm watching it.
It's actually fun fact. I can't really listen to a podcast and do something else. Like, I have to be there to listen and, like, maybe take notes or be immersed in my audio drama experience. So I do carefully watch my podcasts.
Now I'm picturing it's like if you're, like, the, you know, the alien nemesis in some sci-fi movie, it's like the one way to stop you is to just play a podcast. It's like, no! Where's yeah. that sound coming from?
I can't multiple process here. TLDR tip. I think because of your day job experience as a UX designer, I think it'd be beneficial. We had Clayton Notestein in a previous segment of the show, and I would love to get more information for people. We talked about Laws of UX as a website that has some really good information there. But is there anything else additionally around UX design and creating tabletop games, maybe like web design resources or physical layout stuff? What are some, I guess you talk a lot about processes in this episode. So what's like some criteria that you personally follow to make sure like a user experience is up to standard?
That's a great
question. And let me know if that's a too big of a question as well.
You know, I could talk about this for another 10 hours, but that's it's a whole other podcast. Yeah,
that's a whole other 5 podcasts.
I do want to, you know, if I boil it down to a nugget of, I think, what might be most useful for people listening, I think it's the beginner's mind. Always keeping in mind the beginner's mind. I think that is the secret of the best UX designers I know, the best game designers, is that they are always asking themselves the question, regardless of how I personally feel about this, how much I want to put into this book or this web experience or this card game or, you know, whatever it is, the medium that you're designing in, there's this desire to put more in. And the skill, and this is hard, you know, this is painful, because, you know, back to the, I love the way that you put it much earlier in in our conversation of, it's not just always about adding stuff, it's about removing as well. But always asking yourself the question, how is this coming across to someone who is experiencing it for the first time? What order are they experiencing it? Like, and I mean, starting from the very first experience, not because I think it can be easy to very quickly jump to, well, like, first they look at, you know, they go through the introduction, but then they're like in the rules section. It's like, no. Like, how do they come across the book? You know, what was like opening the box? What was the context they had coming into the experience? You know, had they played games before? Had they not played games before? And so on. And I think realizing that there's these two mantras I say to myself that sound super negative, but are really helpful, which is basically, the people experiencing the thing you make don't give a shit about you. It's not about you. It's about them. It's about the experience that they're having. And assume that 98% of what you put on the page is literally going to be ignored. One thing that I always keep in mind is, for example, the way that your eyes work is that you've got the fovea, which is the area of focus that your eye is able to actually do things like read text, like see high resolution stuff, pay attention to. It's the size of it is, if you hold your thumb out at arm's length, it's the size of your fingernail. And so your perception is you're seeing this wide field of view, but your brain is only seeing like this tiny, tiny thing, and it's constantly cicading around. It's jumping around to like fill in the picture. And your brain is actually really good at filling in things that aren't there if it hasn't looked at it for a while. It's your brain is telling a story of what even you can see. And remembering those things helps you when you're making stuff to just essentially always ask the question, what can I cut? And it's always more than you'd like. And some of the techniques of UX, there's so much there, but the UX Laws website, like that's such a nice articulation. I think there's lots of resources on just standard, like all of graphic design, typography, all of that. You know, that's really what it's getting at, is how can I really clearly establish what's the most important thing on the page using like color and size and typography and shape. Like, that's really what it's all about, is like getting back to this idea of, people are essentially throwing away 90% of what you're giving them cognitively. The probably, if I would leave you with like a couple of like really useful kind of tricks or tips and tricks here, the single most useful technique here is going to someone who knows what you're trying to do. Not some like, it's important that people know what your intent is, and asking them, okay, you have to cross out 50% of what I've written. Which 50% would you cross out? And you can dial it up and down. Like I've gone to my friends and said, hey, like here's the zone manual. You can only keep like one page. You know, what do you keep? So that's one thing. That's one like huge thing is that exercise. And you can do that to yourself. It can be helpful to have someone else just brutalize you with it kindly. But it's really clarifying. The second thing is obviously like everyone playtests, but specifically playtesting in a making sure that when you're playtesting, I think that whole adage of like listen to when people tell you how they, you know, how they feel and don't listen to their solutions. I mean, write them down, be inspired by them, but like create environments where people will go through the experience. That's a really obvious one. And then the third tip, this was a huge part of the zone experience, is a lot of the game design process focuses on how do you design the mechanics of the game. And how do you design the core loop of the game? When I was making the zone and doing playtests, I had my notes and I had the kind of prototype of the manual. But what I would do is probably in the first quite a while, actually, instead of reading the manual, when the manual got like baked enough that I could just follow the instructions, I did that. But what I would do is I would take a single sheet of paper and I would write myself like a hit list of like, here are the things I want to hit in what order. And I would pay very careful attention to how I was introducing the concepts to players and how I was landing and trying to link how I introduced the concept to problems that happened later in the game. And you notice these huge shifts where, for example, if you put character creation before explaining certain rules, people felt more invested in the rules because they had just created their characters and they could kind of personalize it. But it also was a trade-off with pacing, where people kind of like to know the rules before they create a character. Mm-hmm. So in the end, I put the character creation first, but I also put in like a very like a rules overview and then explain the rules. I'm kind of doing it twice at different levels. And the way that came about was in this like repetitive process of writing down notes, not the full text, which would force me to verbally explain the game. And then kind of like taking notes of myself explaining it and then writing that down and then using that to come up with the next version. Like I would say like designing the explanation, the onboarding of your game is at least 50% of the work. It's not 10%. It's not like just something you do at the beginning. It's not the like, what is an RPG like chapter? I think it's actually 50% or more of the game design itself. And then you have to let the onboarding actually change the loop of the game itself. So one thing I did, and I would recommend people do this, is literally record yourself explaining the game and then listen to that recording and use that to like come up with the next iteration of doing that, and assume that, you know, you'll do that like a dozen times before you get to like where you want to get, and really think of like the explanation of the game as not the explanation of the game, but as part of the game. That's actually where the experience begins, when you open the box, not when people start playing and they're done with the rules. So that those would be like my three recommendations. The exercise where, aside from the obvious like layout and everything, do the exercise of asking people to like completely decimate your product and tell you which parts they would keep, you know, Marie Kondo it brutally. Two is like playtest, but make sure that when you're playtesting, you playtest in a way where people know what you're trying to do so they can give you accurate feedback. So it's not just about how do they feel. They can say, how well did this experience like hit your goals for the experience? And then number three is to really think of the onboarding as part of the whole experience, not a separate thing. And to literally like record yourself explaining it over and over again. And even better, record other people explaining it and be driven by that when you're writing the book or when you're writing the explanation, instead of just presenting the rules. Like, ask yourself, like, and I think the wrapper concept around all of these is ask yourself how the whole experience is going from the perspective of a new player, from the moment they open the box or click the link to the end of the game, not just the part where they're playing. Like, design the whole thing, and the actual play will be much easier.
It's, I mean, that's awesome. I really think there's something. I think one of the most valuable ones for me is the, like, give it to someone to read and, like, take away the bits that they could live without sort of thing. Because what it's also doing is making sure that you're only key. It's again, like the concept you mentioned earlier, of like taking into account what's not there. Right. And what can be left up to interpretation. Right. So like if someone takes out or crosses out something, it's like what that basically tells me as, you know, as I'm processing this is like what that would tell me is like, oh, this is something that someone could make up. Like if I gave it to 8 people and all 8 people say like, oh, I could live without this page, then it's probably something they're all like, this will probably come naturally through gameplay, like from the other mechanics they kept. So
yeah, and I think also being aware that, because, and I'll say this, like, because I personally feel it, I feel the pressure to have like more content. I think about this tweet someone posted a while back, which is, I looked it up while we were talking, so I wanted to read it out, which is, there's a special feeling when you step into the Louvre and you just know you're seeing some of mankind's greatest content produced by some of its top content creators. It crushed me. It killed me. So there's this feeling of like, I need more content, I need more tables, I need more explanation. Mm-hmm. And I like to think of it in terms of scaffolding and director's commentary. I think some of that content belongs in essentially like, you know, design your game so you have all this like rich sidebar. Like for The Zone, I'm working on this right now, is like a guide website where you can see all of, and this will be in the kind of printed version, but a guide where you can really see like, okay, here are all the tips. Like if you want to, the game will run itself, but if you want to level up as a facilitator, or you want to know what the design intent and, or the history, like this, which game was this move inspired by, like, you know, tell people at Archipelago, like, I really want to credit all these remixes. Like, you know, I think that's a place where a lot of that can go. So it could feel bad to delete your own stuff, but at least, you know, it doesn't mean it needs to, it just needs to be like put in the right place. So make sure that people know what's essential and then let them dive deeper. And the other thing is scaffolding, where create what feels like too little content. And there's a rule up being in The Zone, which is like, let uncomfortable silence, you know, happen. Because people need time to just stay. Like, just because there's a silence doesn't mean someone's stuck. It just means they're creating. So you don't need to like have a rule for everything. You don't need to like always say like, oh, and now just roll from this table. But it can also be cool to give people the escape valve. So as a designer, you can say, oh, well, I cut this from the main flow, but I also have like 15 different ancillary tables. Or like, my dream is to have a game where the core experience is really tight, but literally at any time you can say, I'm stuck, and it'll, oh, I can't think of a mutation. Great. Here's a mutation. I don't know how to start this scene. Press a button. Here's some prompts. Like if every single game could have at every point, like here's a button and you'll get some help, then that's also where some of this extra content can go. So I think if you're listening and you're like, I don't want to cut 90% of my game, like people will then yell at me and say, my PDF is just one page. It doesn't mean cut it. It just means like organize it in the way where people will be able to get to know what's essential, what's like extra credit, and what can support them when they need to be supported.
Just juicing. It's fascinating because I think about from that circumstance, like, okay, so the thing I wrote down that we talked about earlier is for that Heed the Call game, I was trying to basically take fighting game archetypes, the Shoto, the Rushdown, the Zoner, and put them into, like, use that as a class system. Because I think that's something that's not quite explored. Like, there's the leader, the striker, the defender, like, tanks and damage dealers and support. But those are all based on, like, party comps, like, party comp class design. Whereas I think fighting games are, you're only playing with one character, right? So, like, that's solo. How do you bring that solo class structure, then put it into a team composition? And part of that answer is assist games, but then you also think about how to get assist mechanics into a game. But I'm struggling with trying to... Thank you. What I'm struggling with is trying to create those skill sets in a theater of the mind style. And what I wrote down was basically instead of maybe writing player mechanics, I think one of the things I might focus on is only writing enemy mechanics, and then you build your own style based on the enemies you're encountering, and you have like a limited deck size for that. So like, okay, I'm facing a lot of like aerial opponents, so I need an anti-air ability, so I need to craft that and like get pieces, or like have a tagging, or a not a tagging system, but like a Mad Lib system of like, okay, this, if I put this in this card, it has to have this, like just sort of like parameter check things for like quote unquote the balance of the game maybe. But it's fascinating to think about, like, instead of trying to be the designer that builds the class, how about I just be the designer that designs the problem and let you come up with the solution, basically?
That's awesome. Yeah, because then you're letting people... Because then what's really cool about that is that people will be so much more invested in the solution in their character than if they were reading it off, you know, a character sheet, for example. Mm-hmm.
And isn't that how martial arts are constructed anyways? Like, you approach like a fighter problem, and then you adapt your style to that, right? So
that's awesome. Well, and actually, like, even there's like a bridging thing there too, where like even just asking players, how would you approach this? You know, oh, there's, you know, this aerial character is like coming at you. It comes back to that thing we were talking about earlier of pointed questions, like the power of questions in games to help frame, to kind of prime people to think in a certain way. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, I think that might be the answer here today. So thank you for those tips. They're powerful. They're powerful things. And then, you know, I think what building your own fighter also helps with is minimizing the amount of cognitive load someone would have to take to learn the game. Because in its current iteration, you're basically playing a version of 3-card Monty and War all at the same time. So that can, like, those two things of, like, there's a... For anyone who's listening, there's a concept in fighting games called Yomi, which is basically reading your opponent. And it's how you kind of break their combo or get to start your combo in a fighting game or whatever have you. So in the game, I'm basically saying, like, okay, you lay out 3 cards, and then your opponent has to guess if one of those cards is even or odd or black and red or black or red. And then if you want to guess both, that's a perfect read, and that gets you bonuses and stuff.
Love that.
So it's like, oh, your center card is even. And it creates like a 50-50 environment, which means that those are like your odds of the game, essentially. And what's also cool about like a fighting game concept is that in fighting games you have what's called conditioning, where you start to like figure out your opponent's tells, and then your opponent has to adapt to those things to build those. And the beauty about playing cards is that there's card counting. So like every time you use an attack, cards go to the discard pile. So then you start to figure out, like, oh, this is what's left in your deck. Now I can make more accurate plays of, like, oh, you've already played all your spades. There's a pretty good chance that this is a red card here, right? And like that starts to grow and grow and grow. So I think that's basically how the game works, and that's why building your skill set, I think, might be more interesting than having a pre-written skill set.
I could see how those mechanics could create so much drama. It's like replicating that feeling of I'm learning to read the opponent, and then they're learning to read that I'm reading them, and then learning to read that they're reading that I'm reading them. It's like, this is what, you know, it's like the metagame about rock, paper, scissors, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's so deep.
It's so good. It makes me think about Hunter Hunter. But I think with all of that, that is going to bring us to the end of what might be the new longest episode of Draw Your Dice. Certainly probably be a two-parter. Raph, it has been an absolute pleasure having you here today. I've really gotten a joy out of getting to know you here.
Likewise. Thank you for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
Aw. My heart's going to explode. One final outplug of like who you are, where can people find you, where can they find your work so that, you know, if they made it all the way to the end here, they can still find you again.
Well, I'm Raph D'Amico. You can find me on Twitter at Raph D'Amico. And I make The Zone. Everything about it is at thezonerpg.com if you want weird Annihilation style horror. And, you know, you play it now for free. Stay tuned for a Kickstarter for the paper version later this year. And
yes,
you know, thank you for listening.
Also, do you have like UX work that people can look at as well? Like, do you have like a Behance or anything like that?
I don't. My like all my like work portfolio is just not up to date.
No, I'll cut it out. I was curious if like people could also reference your style as well, but they may also get that from The Zone. So.
Well, and here's what I'll tell you, like, it's like two different worlds, right? It's like the UX design is very much like that functional, like, oh, hey, I'm just trying to help someone accomplish a task within this company's brand system. And games are really where you can kind of just be yourself. So
Aww.
It's this is the being UX designer is you, personal style is not as much of a thing there, I would say.
Heard. Good to know. Well, with that, then, I have been Jeremy Gage. It has been a pleasure having you here. I hope you had a good time listening alongside me, because I learned a lot, and I hope you did too. And we will catch you next time. Say bye to the people, Raph.
Bye to all the people. Thank you for listening. You're all wonderful. Jeremy, thank you for hosting.
Wah, thank you. Wah.
The crowd goes wild.
All right, that's a wrap. Thank you for taking the time to sit down and hang out with Raph and I. We really appreciate it. You can find links and resources down below in the show notes, such as getting in touch with Raph or other episodes with similar topics. If you want to be a part of the conversation, please come and join the community Discord server. Also, make sure to subscribe to the Draw Your Dice Patreon, where you can get access to early releases of episodes from as soon as we interview. Thanks again for stopping by, and as always, I will catch you next time.